This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. How does a democratic society defend itself? Can force be an instrument of justice? Beginning with the fact that all war is terrible, how can we decide whether a specific war is justified or not? After September the 11th, these questions of ethics and morality took on new force, and now, after Afghanistan and Iraq, they seem more relevant than ever. They are among the questions that animate Jean Bethke Elshtain's new book, Just War Against Terror, The Burden of American Power in a Violent World. In it, Professor Elshtain sets out criteria for what makes the use of force just or unjust. She discusses the purpose of government and debates the philosophical underpinnings of realism, pacifism, and just war theory. As you consider the issues of war and peace, and what principles or values do you bring to bear? What questions do you ask? How do you decide whether a war is just, and does great power bring great responsibility? Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Jean Bethke Elshtain joins us now from the studios of the campus of the University of Chicago, where she's the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Professor of Social and Political Ethics. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Can you fill in for us a little bit about the origins of just war theory, going back, I guess, to Christian theologians?
I'd be very happy to. It's a long story, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. The origins are traced from the writings of St. Augustine in the 4th and 5th century, when he was confronted, as were Christians of that era, with the reality that the world wasn't going to end anytime soon. The early Christian community had expected the eschaton, or the end of the world, and hadn't really made provision for how they were to continue on if the world, in fact, did not come to an end. World doesn't come to an end, world continues, and in fact, Christians undertake responsibility for that world and how it is to be governed. That leads directly to the issue about force and the use of force. St. Augustine argued variously that, in fact, there were some wars that were justified. All war is a tragedy, but some could be justified if these were undertaken first to protect what he called the common good, in the first instance, to protect a people from slaughter and from harm. That's the responsibility of statesmen, of those we charge with security, as we would now say today. Another just occasion for the use of force might well be to protect those who are not your own nationals, to protect the innocent from harm, innocent being those who can't defend themselves, who may be part of another people or a group inside another nation who are coming to harm, who are being destroyed. And at that point, an obligation of neighbor love, of caritas in the theological sense, might be for you to come to their aid and to use force in order to prevent the harm that would otherwise come to these persons. So the origin lies there. And there are many permutations through the centuries picked up and developed further by the great St. Thomas Aquinas, by the great Protestant reformers like Luther and Calvin, made its way into the thinking of Hugo Grotius and some of the early theorists of what's come to be known as international law. It's now, of course, a discourse that is not specifically or necessarily, let's say, theological. It's made its way into all sorts of conventions and treaties, and has played a vital role in limiting the use of force, in talking about the occasions when force may be appropriately used, and specifically in trying to limit the means deployed once a nation or group of nations have committed themselves to force. So, for example, if we look at the 1922 and 1925 Geneva Conventions that forbade the use of chemical agents in a war theater, that ban quite remarkably held as a war instrument until it was deployed in the war theater between Iraq and Iran by Saddam Hussein, and of course used against his own people. So those who say, I think rather cynically, that all these are nice sounding nostrums, but they have no real effect on how things are done, I think are mistaken. There have been some real effects.
You summarize it into a bunch of questions in addition to the idea of preventing harm to the innocent. And if you'll allow me, I'll just go ahead and read it. First, you write, a war must be openly declared or otherwise authorized by legitimate authority so as to forestall random, private, and unlimited violence. Second, a war must be a response to a specific instance of unjust aggression perpetrated against one's own people or an innocent third party or fought for a just cause. Third, a war must begin with the right intentions. Fourth, a war must be a last resort after other possibilities for redress and defense of the values at stake have been explored. And you throw one more criterion in there. Do not enter a conflict without reflecting on whether the cause has a reasonable chance for success. One should not resort to violence lightly or experimentally.
Yes.
And all of those, I mean, these are grand abstract questions, and I don't mean to trivialize it at all, but you draw a parable to a great American movie, and I was wondering if you would talk about that. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance,
right,
one of my favorites.
Right. It's one of my favorites as well, and I use it in classes here at the University of Chicago. Well, in that great film, great John Ford film, it's a parable about random violence, and how it is brought under the rubric of what we routinely call law and order. And the violent perpetrator is a character named Liberty Valance, who is at liberty to do whatever he wants because there is no law backed up by the threat of coercive force and punishment.
He cows Andy Devine, the sheriff.
Okay, the sheriff has simply abandoned his duties whenever Liberty Valance shows up because he's terrified of the guy and his small band of renegades and cronies. Into this situation bounces the lawyer, Rance Stoddard, played by James Stewart, who is determined that he's going to come and introduce law. There's another character on the scene, played by John Wayne, a really brilliant portrayal, a character named Tom Donovan, who keeps calling poor James Stewart Pilgrim all the time in a kind of condescending tone to suggest, listen, you're pretty naive, buddy, about the way things work, and says, you can't do anything just with those law books. You've got to have this, and he kind of pats his holster. This is a thesis that the lawyer resists rather mightily, and then he, too, finally comes to realize that to really stop Liberty Valance, there has to be some counterforce, some counter pressure, and that in fact, until you stop this random violence, you can't establish a rule of law within which others will not get their ends through the use of random violence. And there will, in fact, be ways to deal with those who would harm the community. And it's a really a brilliant playing out of those themes.
I don't want to give away the ending, but, Jimmy Stewart's one character and John Wayne's another. You might figure it out. Lee Marvin,
he's extraordinary as the villain. And finally, of course, the film really shows a territory that's struggling to achieve some kind of representation on Congress and eventually statehood. And Jimmy Stewart's career as the great peacemaker and lawgiver turns on the fact that it's claimed that he's the fellow who shot Liberty Valance when in fact he didn't do it. It was the John Wayne character who did. Mm. But on the basis of that myth, you have the establishment of an ordered political situation.
Our guest is Jean Bethke Elstein. She's the author of the new book, Just War Against Terror. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Jacqueline, who joins us on the line from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Hi, thank you for the show.
Sure.
The whole concept of a just war is just so ridiculous to me. War as an answer to terrorism or to a problem ignores that it takes a whole series of stages to get to the point before someone deals with the problem. Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, those are people who were put into power by a lot of other parts of the puzzle, including participation by the United States. And to say that war, where you destroy infrastructure and where you murder and maim innocent civilians is a ridiculous answer to the problem.
Well, Jacqueline, with all due respect, I don't think you understand the just war tradition. There are two parts. The part that Neil has already talked about is the criteria that come into play when you evaluate the issue of is there a just or justifiable cause. So not every war, obviously, belongs within the category of a just war. People often point to World War II as a kind of paradigmatic example of a just war, where, in fact, let's take the war in Europe. The opponent was Nazism, and what the world faced was the spread of Nazism, the destruction of the Jews of Europe and other peoples, unless something was done to stop the Nazis. And I dare say that sitting down and talking with Adolf Hitler wasn't going to do that. Now, the other part, please may I continue, the other part of the tradition is that holds that even in a just cause, there are limits to the means that you are permitted to deploy. So it's very interesting within the universe of just war scholars that there is a very vigorous debate about the injustice, if you will, of certain means. That is, even in a just cause, the means may be open to criticism and even condemnation. So that there's a debate, for example, about the saturation bombing, since we're talking about the European theater, of German cities. Was that or was that just that not justifiable given the nature of the Nazi threat? And I myself have argued that it simply isn't permissible, because the primary one of the two primary criteria under the part called jus in bello, or the justness of means, is the principle of discrimination. And the principle of discrimination holds that even in a just cause, you are not permitted to knowingly target civilians. In that war, and part of it, of course, was the weaponry then available, where you just dropped bombs all over the place and hoped that some hit a military target. But there was also an explicit targeting strategy aimed at German cities and at civilian centers on the grounds that this would destroy the morale of the German people and they would stop supporting Hitler.
Or the housing of German workers.
Indeed, indeed so. And I think that this is, you couldn't have these kinds of very important debates, because the whole purpose of thinking in this way is to bring restraints to bear on the use of force, not just to give the green light, but to bring restraints to bear, so that the just war tradition steers a course in between an absolute pacifism on the one hand, which would be quite content to see bad things continue so long as one doesn't oneself get dirty hands by opposing force with force. And then you have the other tradition, which is the basically just the Machiavellian might makes right tradition, where if you've got the power, and it's in your interest, you can just do it, and you don't have to justify it to anybody. And I don't think we want a world in which that reigns, because that's the primary contender against just war, is that might makes right doctrine. And
Jacqueline, get in here quickly.
I would submit that Hitler is a perfect example of someone who was allowed to go unchecked for an incredibly long period of time before other powers in the world decided.
That's exactly right. And it shouldn't have happened. Force should have been used much, much earlier. And I think that
might not have been necessary had those people sought to get in there and do something before it got to the point where we needed war. And the idea,
like what for example? What, for example? There were all kinds of negotiations, as you know.
How about financial sanctions against Hitler? We were still dealing with him, and using products from Germany.
There were financial sanctions against Hitler. As a matter of fact, if you go back and check the history, Germany was in the midst of draconian war reparations and was sanctioned all over the place. That didn't stop it.
Jacqueline, it's a debate we'll continue after the break, but thanks very much for the call. We're talking with author and ethicist Jean Bethke Elstein about just war. 800-989-8255 or TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later this hour, we'll switch focus and talk about the decision to pull U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia and what that may mean for politics inside Saudi Arabia. Right now, we're talking with University of Chicago Professor Jean Bethke-Elstein about her new book, Just War Against Terror. What philosophical principles guide your thinking? What values do you take into account to decide how you feel about the war with Iraq or the war against terrorism? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can send us email at totn@npr.org. And I've got some good questions from the callers. Let's go now to Mike, who's joining us from Newport News in Virginia.
Good afternoon. I'm a retired Army officer, and interestingly enough, just a few weeks ago, finished reading Just and Unjust Wars by Michael Walzer,
yes,
which I'm sure you're familiar with.
I am indeed.
And I wanted to put a plug in for two things. One, a lot of Americans have been really upset ever since President Bush mentioned the idea of preemptive wars, and Michael Walzer says that preemptive wars are just when they meet certain conditions, of course, being imminent danger and stuff. His case study was the Arab-Israeli Six-Day War as an example where the Israelis made a preemptive strike because they realized that through intelligence and buildups on the border, they saw that the Egyptians and the other pan-Arab countries were getting ready to attack. And so, you know, to help themselves with the element of surprise, they went ahead and preemptively struck. And we're living in a society today, unfortunately, where we may have to do those sort of things as the nuclear genie seems to be trying to get out of the bottle. The only other thing I would like to mention, too, that I don't think most Americans quite understand, and you were just talking a few minutes ago about, you know, the heavy use of bombing during World War II and how many innocent lives were killed because of that. This war that we just had in Iraq is the most remarkable war that's ever been fought by any army, where we were able to use such pinpoint accuracy to try and not do a lot of collateral damage. You know, no one's ever been able to do that before. Unfortunately, you know, innocent people still died, but certainly not at the rate that that would ever have happened in the past. And I think we should really be proud of ourselves and the fact that, you know, our government really went out of its way to do that. And in the past, there have been certain instances where we've tried to do that, and much to the detriment of our own soldiers. I want people to understand, you know, during World War II, the Germans hid in the mountaintop Catholic churches in Italy, and we're sniping down at the American soldiers, and instead of us trying to just bomb those or use artillery, we were sending men climbing up the mountain like the 10th Mountain Division to try and extricate those Germans out of there.
I'm not sure that Monte Cassino, the facts would justify your story. I'm not sure the Germans were in Monte Cassino before it was bombed.
But so anyways, I just wanted to mention that, and you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts on preemptive strikes.
Okay.
You bet. The bar to preemption, as I'm sure you know from reading Professor Walzer's by now classic book, is set pretty high. There are even more rigorous criteria that have to be met. And he argues that these can be met, but those cases would be much rarer than when one is responding to a direct act of aggression. Let me just mention very briefly that another issue that is rising to the fore more and more all the time, given that we live in an era of international human rights, is who is responsible for trying to interrupt massive violations of human rights, up to and including the slaughter of tens of thousands of persons, when this is going on, because we say, on the one hand, this is not permitted, this can't go on, but often it does go on because no one does anything to stop it. Rwanda, for example, would be a case in point. And I think there the issue would be, is preemption, that is, you haven't been yourself attacked, but you're entering with the use of force to try to stop others from being destroyed. That's permissible within the theological tradition. It's a harder case to make, actually, within the modern, more legalistic tradition of just war thinking.
Mike, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's an email that sort of follows on his point about accuracy. My fear, writes Jay Mazumdar in Arlington, Virginia, my fear is that the war with Iraq was military so successful that we may lose the notion that war is inherently terrible. We managed to liberate a nation of 22 million people while causing fewer than, well, he says 1,000 civilian deaths. I think I heard a report on Morning Edition this morning that put the figure higher than that. But anyway, the scale is about
But remarkably small,
few. Is it possible that war, he writes, when waged by our increasingly precise methods, may not be so taboo in the future?
I think that's it's a very good thought, and it's a very legitimate concern because, in fact, with precision-guided weaponry, I think 85% of the weapons used in the Iraq theater were of that nature. You can really adhere to the principle of discrimination more closely than ever before. Indeed, I would say that the ethical restraint, that we should set that standard very, very high because we have means now that mean we're better able than ever before to abide by it. But that also, I think it's a worry, might make the use of force rather more tempting. And that's why we always have to have the kind of ethical consideration, the kind of really rather extraordinary debate we had in the run-up to the Iraq War. I think that's always incumbent upon us, especially in a democratic society.
Let's go now to Marie Louise, who's in Palo Alto, California.
Yes, good morning. I guess I have the thought that it becomes left to the superpowers, the so-called superpowers, those with the fantastic amounts of military equipment. It becomes left to them to have the option of preemptive strikes because it is obviously not possible for very many other countries to do this. So this keeps the balance on this earth pretty much as it has been going, that some larger countries go off and help themselves to natural resources of countries other places on the earth. But a country such as, for example, Chile, when they were hit on 9/11/1957, they certainly... you know, a country like that doesn't have much chance, does it, with a country like the United States that somehow can decide what is right or what is wrong in the world. So that would be my comment.
Okay, Marie, thank you. We might very well differ on the historic discussion of Chile, but let's leave that aside for a moment. You've raised some very important points. One of the reasons that I think continuing to lift up, if you will, and to reaffirm the just war tradition is that, in fact, when you're dealing with a superpower, you really do need, it seems to me, internally to have ways to have debates about the kinds of restraints that should be brought to bear. That's why in my book I emphasize the responsibility theme, that in fact with this power comes certain very heavy responsibilities that might very well include stepping in to protect those who are being slaughtered when there's no self-interest of your own at stake at all. That may well be a burden of your superpowerdom, if you will. You should also know that within the just war tradition, wars of aggrandizement, wars of territorial expansion are pretty much by definition not acceptable, so that one could make and is obliged to make that kind of evaluation at each and every point.
Well, it's one thing with aggrandizement and for power, but it seems to me that today we live in an economic world. I think maybe I got cut off there.
No, you didn't.
You're coming through.
It just seems like when we live in a power like this, for example, for years, you know, I have felt that, my goodness, how could people go on in South Africa and do the things they've done to the countries there? But somehow it seemed all right for people, for them, to, you know, to take what they needed, to take what they didn't need, but what they wanted out of Africa. And, you know... their lives, just, it can't be sustained, a life with water, a life with a place to grow things and such. So I'm not saying it was a wonderful place before in every which way. However, I do feel like we just don't have the rights to do this to other places in the world. And the United States, I think, must wake up to who pays for the freedom that, or the freedoms that seem to be given here and taken often.
I'm not quite clear about the major point that you were making in your last set of comments, but
yeah, I think I said a little too much. I'm sorry.
Well, no. I'm no doubt my fault that it didn't come through to me at least as clearly as it might. But let me just indicate that whatever the sins of the past on the part of any country anywhere, we have to deal with the realities of the situation in which we find ourselves, and that situation is one in which the bipolarity, as it was called, of the Cold War is gone. That, in its own rather awful way, was a source of some stability because it meant that there was always a worry on the part of the superpowers that small conflicts might escalate, you know, proxy conflicts might escalate into some confrontation between the superpowers. That's not the world we're in anymore. We also live in a world in which all sorts of things travel very, very quickly. Technology does, capital does, but also, as we saw in 9/11, the possibility of exporting terror is another dimension of the world of which we're a part. So how do you legitimately go about interdicting and stopping those sorts of activities, even as you struggle to try to help others who haven't got the kind of political stability that we have that makes possible economic development? We do live in an economic world, but it is overwhelmingly a political world. And in those horrific situations that we now routinely call failed states, there's no possibility at all that economic assistance is going to make a difference because there's no political structure and infrastructure that makes possible the use of these resources. So the preeminent tasks remain the political tasks. And that's a huge challenge. And obviously, it isn't one that the United States alone can or should respond to.
Yeah. Marie Louise, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Here are some of the other headlines at NPR News today. With a new Palestinian prime minister and cabinet sworn in, Western diplomats have presented a new Middle East peace plan. The United States, the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations are proposing a Palestinian state by 2005. And in Iraq today, there was another day of clashes between anti-American demonstrators and U.S. troops in Fallujah. Two Iraqis were reported killed. We'll get details on those stories from NPR's Vicky O'Hara in Washington and Guy Raz in Fallujah later today on All Things Considered. From NPR News here on Talk of the Nation, we're speaking with Jean Bethke Elstein about her new book, Just War Against Terror, The Burden of American Power in a Violent World. She's a professor of ethics and policy at the University of Chicago, where she's joining us from. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Chad, who's with us from Freeport, Maine.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question concerns her initial criteria for a just war. Now, I see it's that implies that there is someone judging it, and of course, it's wholly possible that, say, in a dictatorship, there could be a just war indulged by the dictator. But in a democracy, it seems like it would be the people who judge a just war. And the reason I bring this up is because in following kind of the run-up to war and everything, I didn't hear a whole lot of commentary about sort of the neoconservative thinking and values underlying it until the war was actually being raised. And then there was a front-page article in the Wall Street Journal, and the Times started to cover that a little bit more. So I would just like to hear a little bit about, in a democracy, if a war is indeed just when people aren't informed fully of what's going on.
It's interesting. Just before you answer that, we had an email very much along the same lines from Tim in Portland, Oregon, and he says the discussion presupposes a sort of third-person omniscience. Other than in clear cases like World War II, the urge to war may lead to rationalization or even fabrication, and he cites the Gulf of Tonkin incident in Vietnam and perhaps what may be the nuclear materials importation from Niger in the case of Iraq.
Well, that latter, the email, again, gestures to a very real concern. And part of the just war tradition, the reason that there are criteria that have to be discussed and debated, part of the rationale for that is, in fact, to be able to assess a reasoned explanation and justification from a mere rationalization. But let me go directly to the question from Chad. Chad, I have a hunch that in a dictatorship, it would be very hard to meet all of the criteria that the just war tradition insists have to be met in order to argue that a cause is justifiable, in part given the nature of those kinds of regimes where all sorts of things, as you know, are simply determined by fiat. And it is impossible to have the kind of discussion that the just war tradition really assumes must go forward, not necessarily among millions of people, but certainly among a significant number of people, in order that the judgments of statesmen and stateswomen can be prudentially reasonable assessments and reasonable judgments. So you can't just have one person, you know, making the determination.
Yeah, but doesn't any state have an inherent right of self-defense if they're attacked?
Absolutely. But indeed, and in that sense, you could have just cause, I suppose, if a dictatorship was just sitting there minding its own business and was attacked, although, as we know historically, dictatorships usually don't just mind their own business. But you could hypothesize such a case, indeed. But remember, those aren't the only criteria. You have to also look at the other criteria in order to make that final determination. The authorization for war, of course, came through the elected representatives of the American people. So it's not as if the public was simply blindsided by this, because all of those deliberations take part out in the open, and we have a way to argue back and to make our views known before such determinations are made.
Yeah, so in our society, I mean, it just seemed to me that following the run-up to war, all the values weren't really disclosed until the war started. And, I mean, I have a liberal bias, but when I speak mm-hmm. with conservative friends who don't, you know, they kind of feel the same way, actually, that they didn't really have a clear sense of what this was all about until it started.
Hmm. Well, what do you think it was all about, Chad? I mean, what is the
and very quickly, Chad, because
yeah.
we're running out of time here.
Sure.
Right.
I mean, quickly, it seems like quite a bit of this is a strategic geopolitical move in the region, much more than it is, you know, about the humanitarian suffering of the Iraqi people. I mean, of course, it's complex, but I think it's that geopolitical sense that we weren't really fully informed of.
Okay, we'll discuss that after we come back from a break. We've got to cut away right now. But, Chad, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
We're going to continue our conversation with Jean Bethke Elstein about her book, Just War Against Terror. And also, we're going to switch subjects and talk about Saudi Arabia and the withdrawal of U.S. troops and whether that might ease tensions in the Arab world and specifically in Saudi Arabia. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, as the president prepares to announce the end of the combat phase of the war, as he addresses the American people from the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln in the Pacific Ocean on its way to San Diego, join us for a discussion of what would constitute a victory in Iraq. He's not ready yet to declare victory. That will be tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. We're talking now with Jean Bethke Elstein, the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Professor of Social and Political Ethics at the University of Chicago, about her new book, Just War Against Terror. And I wanted to ask you, we got an email from Steve, who writes,
okay.
Just war theory seems rather limited, he says. How do you define terms like unjust aggression? Seems to depend on where you sit. Osama bin Laden apparently felt that attacking America was justified even by Allah because U.S. has projected its military power into the Islamic world. What makes his just war any less just than President Bush's counterattack?
There are some criteria that would enable us to make that decision, and I would argue that they are not limited to Western thinking alone. And one of the primary restraints within the just war tradition is that no holy war, no crusade can ever be acceptable, because that is by definition a war that has no legitimate limits and that targets people indiscriminately simply because they are the wrong nation or the wrong religion and so on. And some of my Islamic friends Americans and as students of the Islamic tradition I'm thinking about or argue that, in fact, they have corollary concepts within the Islamic tradition that make very similar arguments. So I don't think we're just in this subjective universe where everything is whatever somebody says it is.
Okay, and one final call. Barbara's on the line with us from Corvallis, Oregon.
Hi, I'd like to know how the just war theory would apply to this post-war period. What does it imply about the U.S. running things versus the U.N., that kind of thing?
In Iraq, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a terrific question. And Barbara, I have to say that you've really pointed to an area in the just war tradition that needs further development, the justice of the post-war period. And I think that one of the worst things we could possibly do, having helped to create a situation, is simply to march away, to declare victory and march away, that our responsibility extends to helping to the Iraqi people to create a stable situation. Of course, we occupied Germany and Japan for a considerable period of time after World War II, and the outcome was, of course, a salutary one. It doesn't mean you stay permanently and doesn't mean you run the show, but you have a responsibility to really see to it that a viable political order in which people are not treated in the way they were under the old regime is in place.
Doesn't it, to some extent, define what the war was for if we, for instance, were to gain economically from the outcome? Instead of maybe serving the Iraqi people by having the UN there and being more credible.
The question would be about the UN is obviously going to have a role, but the question is what kind of role will the UN have? The UN is pretty good at some forms of humanitarian relief, although even there, people that I've talked to in various parts of the world, including some camps on the West Bank and Gaza, are not pleased with the way the UN does those kinds of things. That's another story altogether. Yeah. But at any rate, it seems to me that this has to be not exclusively an American effort. It has to be multinational, has to be international. All kinds of groups have to be in there and playing a part. Absolutely.
Barbara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Jean Bethke Alstein, thank you. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Always happy to join you.
Her new book is Just War Against Terror, The Burden of American Power in a Violent World, and she joined us from the studios at the University of Chicago.